It's 9:26, it's Monday morning. I'm delighted to welcome journalist Dan Marie Horan to studio. Thank you for coming to see us. Lovely to see you. It's been a long time, actually.
It has been a long time. Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Your book is called Sorry for Your Trouble, The Irish Way of Death. And I think that it's important to stress before we begin, and people might think, oh, no, I'm not up for death now on Monday morning. It's not about that as such, is it? Is it a meditation? How would you describe it?
It's kind of, how would I describe it? Yeah. It's a look at life through death, maybe, is a way to describe it. It's, I wanted the book to be surprising.
Yes.
There were only two things that really guided me when I wrote Sorry for Your Trouble. I wanted it to get out of Dublin and I wanted it to be surprising.
Yes.
And interesting. Above all, to me, I wanted to be kind of going, oh, my goodness, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. So that's what kind of guided me. So I want the book to be, I wanted it to be kind of quite, which sounds a strange thing for a book on death, but kind of quite pacey.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
I wanted it to move. and because otherwise I thought, oh, my God, I'm just going to get bogged down, and I don't want anybody getting bogged down.
Especially when you, I presume you wrote it in the last 18 months, 2 years, and
a bit longer.
A bit longer again, because when you think of what's been happening in the world, and I'm sure in your life, we'll get to that later, but what a time to be writing about something ostensibly so morbid and taking that on and going, now is the time. I'm stuck indoors. I'm travelling along, as you describe many times, on lonely roads, physically, emotionally. You know, it was quite an unusual subject matter to take on in such a horrible time.
Yeah, no, well, I took it on way before COVID. Yeah. And then when COVID hit, I was going, like everyone else, I was just stunned. And I think the way that it kind of rocketed, it shot us into a new reality was really interesting.
Yeah.
And that whole aspect of COVID, for carers, for people at home on their own, everything, I think a lot of that was quite similar to grief, you know, that silence, that loneliness, all those things are quite similar to grief. And to, you kind of felt that death could suddenly, we kind of feel always we have death kind of sorted, you know, and it only happens when you're old and expecting it. Yeah. But suddenly with COVID, we were jettisoned into this area where death could get you any time.
Wartime.
We had a disease that we didn't understand yet. And that was very salutary, I think, for us all. And also made us think about all the people through the ages who've gone through plagues and famines and invasions.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, nowhere to run. So that was very interesting.
How are we as a people on death? Because we often say we're great talkers, but I feel we're great talkers, but we often say nothing.
Yeah.
And equally we say, oh, we're great with death, but I don't think we discuss it at all. Yeah, sure, we do the wake, and but actually the post-funeral scenario is the one where it's the darkest, really.
Yeah, but for sure.
But for the death itself, I think we're delighted with ourselves at our approach to this.
No, but that's why I think that this is really why I wanted to write the book. Because we are delighted with ourselves around death and we're very confident about it.
In what way?
Well, I just think we feel it's one of the things we're good at. Everybody knows what to do around a death, around a funeral.
Yeah.
The roles, they know the rhythm of it. Of course, COVID disrupted this as well. But we know the rhythm of it. Even the phrase, sorry for your trouble, kind of covers everything.
Yeah.
And it's a great phrase. And
I said that to Bernard O'Shea once on the Late Late Show. And your father died. He said, yes. I said, I'm sorry about that. He said, why? What did you do?
I know.
You know, it's the guy, he was being smart, trying to obviously detonate the tension with a bit of humour. But
I think sorry for your trouble is a great phrase because it's very gentle. It covers everything, no matter what the circumstances of the death. So that's why I chose it for the title of the book. But I really, it was our confidence around death that really made me look at it, because I was going, we're very confident around death. Irish people, we think we're great at death. And then I thought, well, has anybody actually looked at this intimately? Have you? Has anyone really gone in on close up here and seen what it's like in modern Ireland? And I didn't think that anybody had at any great length. And I just thought, you know, this is a real opportunity to take, because death, the universality of death, it unites us all, really.
Yes.
It's a traveller. It moves around. It was a great opportunity to kind of have a window into everyday life in Ireland and to look at ordinary daily life, yes, which is what I really like to do.
And funerals, like, for example.
Yeah, a lot of funerals.
You love a good funeral. And people say, you know, what are you, you know, why are you wearing a tie or whatever? And I'm going to a funeral. And then you come back from the funeral, go back to work. How was it? It's a very Irish question. How was the funeral?
Yeah.
So, you know, it's quite hard to answer. But actually, reading your book, there are some great funerals. Like, there's
there are great,
like,
funerals.
A good funeral. Like, I always say, and I would love people to have the crack at my funeral, for example. Yeah. That's bleak to say that, but I would love them to go to a particular pub. I want to hear. Yeah. I want them to roar laughing and
have a party.
Please, please. You know, even an older relative of mine died, and she said at the funeral, everyone wears something bright. And, you know, she was in her 80s, and I went to the funeral, and everyone was wearing bright, and it was actually very beautiful. And because the Irish, you know, Catholic tradition is pretty, it's obviously morose, all these words. There's not much cracking.
No, but it's very strict in that way of what can do.
Wasn't always thus, though, was it? I mean,
no,
you talk
sure.
about the games and the singing and
for
the
sure.
shenanigans.
Well, I just want to say that not all funerals are that sort of traditionally somber. I don't mind a bit of somber, but... Big Tom was a fantastic funeral.
Really?
And that had everything, because it was somber in the church.
Respectful,
very conventional, nothing out of the ordinary as a Catholic funeral. And then we came out and went up the hill to the grave. Mm. And there was an empty wheelchair being passed through the crowd. And I'm going, anything could happen here. And suddenly, Ireland's country stars start singing through a fantastic PA system. I mean, it was all brilliantly organised. And there's Daniel O'Donnell and there's Sandy Kenny and there's Philomena Begley and Susan McCann. And they all have numbers and they all sing them. The crowd all sing.
Yeah.
And then two couples started jiving down on the road.
What a send-off.
But it was a fantastic send-off. And also, I can see there, you can see there, everyone knew what to do. No one was surprised. Mm. Big Tom was about dance music and people danced.
Yeah.
It was brilliant. I think we kind of tend to, you know, really strive for to be respectable, to be irreproachable, not to let ourselves down in front of the neighbours at funerals. And that's kind of a shame. And in a way, it's new because there used to be the Irish wake was something else. I mean, it was really something else. Mm. And we used to, the corpse would be laid out. It would be a 3-day funeral if you died in the morning. It'd be a 2-day funeral if you died in the afternoon. The young people used to ask the old people to die in the morning to make sure they did. And then they would, before the burial, when the corpse was there, maybe in a barn, maybe in a kitchen, the community would gather, old people during the day, young people at night. And there were forms, there were games, a very strong pattern. There was Borokin, who was the guy who coordinated the whole, he was like a master of ceremonies.
Yeah.
He was like a host.
Big event. Yeah.
William Carleton says, who was born in the late 18th century, says where he grew up in Tyrone, you'd go 5 miles for a funeral. The boys would walk 5 miles for a funeral. The girls would go 1 or 2 miles.
Right.
So for a wake. So this was a major social event. And they had games we would recognise, like games of forfeit, imitation games, satire on the local authority figures, like Sir Sop was the English guy. There was the police game. There was the priest. They sometimes played the priest with a rosary made out of potatoes. Like, nobody was immune from this. But there were also a lot of, how shall we put this, pretty explicit games, sexually explicit games. And every... So there was that aspect of it. And then there were the keeners, who were these women who came. They were either paid in money or drink. And they let loose when they came into the wake. Absolutely let loose.
Kind of ululating and...
Ululating. Yeah, yeah. And also they would extemporize. They were kind of like jazz singers.
Yeah, okay. Free form mourners.
Yeah. Yeah, free form mourners. Okay. And try to outdo each other.
Okay.
You know, there was competition.
Wow.
And then they would come back. They'd often be there throughout the funeral. They'd ride on the coffin to the graveyard if they... if they were, you know, if they had, if they'd been paid enough money, basically.
Yes.
And then if it was a young person, they'd go and keen at the grave. They'd keen outside the house before the coffin left the house. The coffin would be on chairs and they'd keen there. And then when the coffin was picked up by the men to move off, the chairs would be knocked over. But I mean, that was all after games which were very sexually explicit, like the building of the ship. For example, which went in stages. It was the men, as far as we know, the building of the ship, you know, the laying of the keel, the painting of the ship, the erection of the mast.
And on it goes.
And on it goes. And then drawing the ship out of the mud. And the people who commented on this, we have, this is why I'm very kind of strong on ordinary life.
Yes.
This was ordinary life.
Yes.
The church tried to ban it. It threatened to excommunicate people. I mean, it was very, very strongly against it. But the only people who wrote this down were sort of middle-class intellectuals who were interested, but they were unbelievably disapproving of the whole thing. And that's the only reason we have records of it.
Through some kind of priggish
writer. Likely uptight.
Okay. And actually probably dying to have a go.
Yeah.
Most
and also fascinated. But I mean, we must be grateful to them because there's nothing. They're the only record we have. But they were wild times.
Well, I have to say, they sound like great fun.
Yeah.
Maybe we should consider a return to form. But Bernie is a woman. Bernie Brady Walsh is a woman you chronicle and her life and death in the book.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you alight on her and what does she represent, do you believe?
Well, that's a good question. I didn't alight on her. I had to work very hard to get into the hospice, to win their trust.
Sure.
They were very correct. About
I mean alight as in, I don't mean it's like you kind of swept down like a hawk.
I was allowed to talk to three or four people who were residents in the hospice.
Yes.
And Bernie was the one. One lady dropped out because she wanted to spend more time with her kids. That was fine. One lady then couldn't speak and so on. So Bernie and I sort of formed an alliance. She was only in the hospice for about 8 weeks. Mm-hmm. She went in the beginning of June and she died on the 2nd of September. Oh, she went in the end of June. She died the 2nd of September. What does she represent to me?
Well, she worked in a very famous cleaners in Baggot Street called the Craft Cleaners. And I remember being out, kind of my mother's knee waiting to collect whatever she was collecting in the cling film and the good cleaners. It was the good cleaners.
It was when your
mother
would say...
I'm probably saying something about myself there.
No, your mother would say, oh, I'll take that to Craft.
There you go.
That meant a whole lot of stuff.
But behind the counter was probably Bernie.
And she went there when she was 14. She started work when she was 14. While she was still at school, actually. And she worked there for a lot of her life, and then she got married and she had her daughter Jennifer, and then her marriage broke up just as she was having her second child Keith, and she went to work in Marks and Spencer's and got married again to Mick. So Bernie herself would say, and often did say, I'm just a normal person, you know, I'm just an ordinary person. But to me, she was so surprising, so impressive, because she just took her death. She was only 58. You know, she was younger than me. She took it and she tried to make all her funeral arrangements, choosing her coffin, choosing her music, writing the eulogy, which she wanted read at the funeral, making sure all the bills were changed into her husband's name, on the phone to the insurance people, on the phone to, you know, the property tax people, whatever. Always, you know, from the bed, she was coordinating the whole thing. And I kind of said, and it was very unusual. Even the people in the hospice said it was very unusual. The guy who celebrated her funeral said he'd never had anybody ring him up before and say, I'd like you to celebrate my funeral.
She produced, as we'd say in this business.
Yeah, she produced
her own funeral.
That's
and her end of game, end of days, I should say.
And when I asked her why she did this, she said, I don't want the children to have to do it. I don't want the children hanging
over.
She wanted to protect them. They were stressed enough, I think she felt. Yeah. Now, that emerged over a long period of time. She didn't kind of come out with that. But she didn't want the children faced, you know, with what was Mammy's favourite song just after she died. Yeah. You know, she didn't want them to worry about the detail.
Remarkable. Yeah. I mean, really quite remarkable.
But you see, that's it.
Why was she not consumed with her own mortality? Why was she not expending that energy on reflecting on the why and the where of the end of her life? These are rhetorical questions, but, you know, somebody else would have been doing that and be too miserable, sad, upset.
Well, I think she did do all of that, Ryan, but she did this as well. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't an either-or situation.
But I think, think that if I was her, I think I understand why she did all of that, because it would distract me from the reality of the existential crisis that facing me, which is exactly what it wasn't, which is an existential. You no longer exist to have that crisis. Yeah. So I think I'd be on to organising the food, the finger food for the post-match analysis. You know, that's where I'd be going.
Well, you see, she it wasn't that she didn't feel it, Ryan.
No,
it
was, of course, I understand.
No, but I mean, like she said, when the guy from The Undertakers had just left, she said, you know, it's quite chilling to think of yourself to going into that black box. You know, I mean, she wasn't superhuman, but she was just an incredibly, I mean, what is the definition of courage? Grace under pressure. I mean, that was, she just handled the whole thing so well.
What was it like for you? I'm not her family, I'm not being disrespectful to her family, but when she died, how was it for you? How did you...
Well, first of all, I'd never seen anybody die before. I only realised that as I came into the room, the deathbed room. I went, oh, yeah, I've never done this before. It was at the early parts of it, I was very busy because I was note-taking. I was trying to make sure I had everything right. I was all of those make sure. I just thought to myself, very few writers get this opportunity. You know, time to, you know, be up your game and get this right, because you're not going to have a second go. So there was that aspect of it. And also, I had felt that Bernie, I think a lot of the people who had seen her in the preceding week, we'd actually were afraid that she was going to die the week before. So there was that aspect to it. I also wanted to try and stay out of everybody's way. And I was just writing, you know, watching, writing. And that went through right until after the funeral and Bernie's cremation. Everybody, she worked at Marks and Spencer's in retail all her life, and she worked at Marks and Spencer's, and everyone came to the funeral, and some people, it was packed out, and some people were there with their Marks and Spencer's name badges on it. It was fantastic.
When she died, that moment in the room, you had to be a shadow, and you'd never seen somebody die before.
No.
At that moment when you knew it was over and her life had ended, was that profound for you?
I wouldn't posh it up to profound at that point. You know, I just thought, for her suffering, if you're asking for me, my reaction, her suffering is over. You know, that's what I really felt. And I, there was a lot of grief. She was a wonderful mother. There was a lot of grief in the room from her children, Keith and Jennifer. You know, I was concerned for them. For them, because they were going to have to live without their mother, who they, who they really got on with, who they really liked, as well as loving her. They had great crack with her. She was a great person. So those were, I was kind of making sure that I was moving through it. You know, I was making sure that I knew where to go. As I say, that I wasn't imposing myself.
You don't want to make it your story.
No.
I see. She moves through the boom. I'm just thinking, as you say, she moves through the grief. And this is like
she moves through the gloom.
Better. Okay, I'll tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to take an ad break.
Okay.
Will you stay with us? Because the reaction I can see is enormous. Irish people love to talk about this. So as always with you, you're on the money, and you know what people like to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really healthy. So I'm really enjoying this conversation in a strange way. It was always good to see you, Anne-Marie. We're with Anne-Marie Horahan live in studio this morning. The book is called Sorry for Your Trouble, The Irish Way of Death. But the story takes many twists and turns, and we're going to get to some of the messages. We have somebody who'd like to talk to us on the radio as well. And we'll talk further about your book after this break. Back in a sec.
The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1.
All right, 11 minutes to 10. So we don't have a whole heap of time, but we're chatting with Anne-Marie Horahan this morning about her book called Sorry for Your Trouble. And there's so many places to go, but I do want to ask you about your dad, who was a doctor. He was a skinny man. You mentioned this a few times, like a thin man, I should say. But somebody who you got Parkinson's, he was unwell. And suddenly, as you're writing this book, you find yourself in the thick of the very subject you're writing about in many ways.
Yeah, no, for sure. I have to say, because there'd be people with Parkinson's and their families listening to this, my dad had, he had a lot of very good years with Parkinson's where he was still able to enjoy life. He was golfing, he was driving. He did remarkably
good.
Well. Because the whole thing about Parkinson's is, oh my God, it's all doom and gloom. Mm. And that wasn't his experience. However, then at the beginning of 2020, things started to go downhill and life became increasingly difficult for him. So he had to go to hospital, which was very difficult because there was no visiting. And that is really hard. And to me, that was for him and for us, but more especially for him, not to have visitors, not to see your family. He wasn't a mobile phone guy, right? He wasn't a texter, those things.
Mm. Old school.
Mm. And then he moved to a nursing home, but he didn't know. And at the time we were talking to him about it, we didn't know that when you went to a nursing home, you had to quarantine for 14 days, which meant that you didn't see anybody except your carers. Also, there were no visitors. You could only see your loved one through the window. The windows, a beautiful nursing home, mm-hmm. lovely modern windows, mm-hmm. but the windows opened out. So they'd only open out about 18 inches and you had to reach under the pane to hold his hand. And like a lot of old people, a lot of Parkinson's patients, his voice had become very low, which I can tell you in earlier life, it was quite the opposite. You could hear him streets away. Okay. In fact, you can hear all of us streets away. But anyway, that was the worst part for me and for him, because the isolation. And I was saying, Dad, it's COVID rules. Do you understand? Mm. He said, I do understand. I just don't believe it, It was terrible for him. Terrible. That part of it.
Yes.
And then, so he was back in the nursing. He was in the nursing home and I got a call in the early hours of the morning to say, your father says we should call an ambulance. Right. So, and I said, well, what do you think? And they said, well, The lady said, I think I should call an ambulance. I said, I think we should call an ambulance then. And that was when he died. Then he died within 3 hours of that call.
The immediate, being told that news, how did that?
Well, you see, what happened was, it's like a lot of modern deaths, and kind of we're very fortunate in this. We knew, we were almost certain. He'd been in and out of hospital so many times, and I'd followed the ambulance a good few times, you know. So it wasn't a shock to me in that respect. I was thinking maybe he'd come out, maybe he won't come
out. So when did that, I appreciate that very much, but I think so being told is one thing, but then there's a realisation of the infinite non-return of this person.
Yeah.
That's an odd way of putting it, but just it's over beyond any word in the English language can explain death. Did you have that moment? Maybe not yet.
I think when he went in, a nurse came and got me and said, "Doctor wants to talk to you," because he went into the COVID end of A&E, which everyone who comes from a nursing home went into, and so it was empty. He was the only person in there, and And basically, the doctor, who's an extremely nice woman, said, call the family. And I said, I can't call them now. It's 3 o'clock in the morning. You know, I was kind of in denial. And she said, no, call them. Yeah. And then I knew this. And my brother said to me, is this it? And I said, yeah, it is it. But at the same time, because he was so miserable on his own in the nursing home, and his future was grim, and he knew it was grim. And there was no light at the end of the tunnel. There was no, oh, by the way, we're going to reopen the nursing homes in a month, or, you know. So I couldn't be sorry that he died. You know, holding his hand and being with him and all the rest of it, I couldn't say, which I know a lot of people say at deathbeds and with good reason, don't die, don't die. But I couldn't do that, really. And I think I only started to really experience the moments that you're talking about a long time after.
I always say about this, the woman I met on the pier in Dunleary shortly after my father died, and she said, because I was very affected by that chapter in your book, by the way, and anyone who's been through it, you write it so beautifully and thoughtfully, and the woman said to me, how are you doing? And do you know there's a post almost mortal euphoria?
Yeah, there is. It's the adrenaline, isn't it?
Man,
yeah.
It was like, it was crazy. I was like, what was that? And it went on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then you make, anyway, life goes on. And this woman said, I said, yeah, I'm doing great. You know, I was kind of didn't realize. And she said, I'll see you in a couple of months' time.
Yeah.
And sure enough, then it was the cloud over the head going, where's this going? Yeah. So it's very, and I think you capture that beautifully. Okay, Anne-Marie, we have some, as I said, text says, Mary and Ballincollig, we're not afraid of death, we're afraid of dying.
Yes,
the manner in which we're going to die is the fear we have.
That's true.
Okay, and lovely to hear Anne-Marie on the radio. We worked together as contact tracing volunteers last year. Did you, well, good on you.
I only did, UCD. Loads of people did, an awful lot. I only did a little.
Okay, well, you're being elevated here. Frank, it says, my father died, he says, on the 30th of October in 2020. And as we say, sorry for your trouble, as per the title. But we've so much here that we're going to have to deal with these in the morning. But enormous reaction to what you've been talking about. And it feels mildly cathartic, if I may say such a thing. But congratulations on your book. And I think it's not before time. And it's been lovely having you on the show this morning.
Ryan, thank you.
As always, Anne-Marie Harahan joining us. And again, her book title is Sorry for Your Trouble, The Irish Way of Death. It's a beautiful, insightful reflection on a very, very peculiar country's approach to the oddest experience of them all. At 4 minutes to ten. Just an absolutely enormous response to that conversation with Anne-Marie Harahan this morning, and thank you for all that. And you know, people feel so differently, don't they, about death and funerals. And Liam rightly says, I've heard it said that a good funeral is way better than a mediocre wedding. Well, I couldn't agree more. And another says about death and the atmosphere around it. It's a little bit like Schadenfreude, isn't it? That's what it is. We're okay. We've dodged the bullet. We're not the dead person. We're still here. There's an element of that. Just a more morbid thought, but sure, why not? Irish people are great for turning up for the wake, but where were they for the nursing home visits and the thoughtful cards and the phone calls? Well, there's an interesting strain I noticed in the text this morning. A lot of people have an anger towards death and towards other people's attitude towards it. Who shows up here? Who does that? Who pulls their weight? Who does? And it throws up all of that. It's like Succession with coffins. I mean, it's just that sense of of rivalry and laziness and pulling their weight and so on. So let's keep that going. We'll get to a lot of these messages, I think, tomorrow, and reflect on those. And there was a caller standing by. Thanks to her for her patience. We'll talk to her tomorrow for sure. But it's coming up to 10 o'clock, so let's say goodbye for now. Stay tuned for Claire Byrne, who's standing by. Have a wonderful day, won't you all? And we'll see you tomorrow.
The Ryan Tuberty Show. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.